Great to have you with us here on WPR News. Larry Mueller here, starting the day today by talking about how the class of weight loss drugs, including, let's see, Ozempic is one, Wegovy another one. Those are two that anytime I turn on the television, I hear ads for Ozempic and Wegovy, and there are some other ones as well. But these drugs can lower your risk for heart attacks. And we'll talk about that today with Dr. Maya Safarova, a cardiologist with Froedtert and the Medical College of Wisconsin. Maybe you're struggling with your weight, wondering about your cardiovascular health, perhaps. Are you a good candidate for GLP-1 medication? Maybe you're already on it. Love to hear your comments about that as well. Give a call, the number 1-800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Dr. Safarova, thank you very much for joining us today. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Larry, for having me. I'm excited to be here to talk about this incredibly important topic.
Well, these drugs, and Ozempic and Wegovy are just two. I think there are at least a couple of others. How do they work in the system? What are they doing?
Yeah, that's always good to know. What are we starting with? So this is a glucagon-like peptide type 1, or GLP-1 agonist. That's what the abbreviation that we typically hear. And GLP-1 is a hormone that all of us, we produce in the gut. And what it does, it regulates blood sugar and appetite. What these medications do, they mimic this hormone, and initially they were of particular interest for the treatment of type 2 diabetes, and then it came to obesity. What happens when these medications are used is that there's insulin release that is being stimulated, there's slowing of the digestion, and as a result, there's increase in satiety or increase in the feeling of fullness. You mentioned some of popular brand names, and we'll talk more about Ozempic, Wegovy, Zepbound. They all are going under this umbrella of nutrient-stimulated hormones. So there's this term, nutrient-stimulated hormone, and GLP-1 is one of the FDA, or Food and Drug Administration, approved therapeutic targets. So, for instance, Ozempic or semaglutide and liraglutide are GLP-1 receptor agonists. But there's also GLP-1 and GIP receptor agonist. GIP stands for glucose-dependent insulinotropic polypeptide, or GIP. So these combination drugs, this is tirzepatide, and for instance, Zepbound is one of those examples. So that's something that we produce, and these medications, they mimic what we produce.
I was looking at the numbers on this, and I last fall, I think there were more than 30 million people taking this medication for weight loss. Were you surprised by the popularity of these drugs?
No, not at all. You know, we talk about epidemic of obesity, not just in the United States. It's a global epidemic. It's a global problem, and it's a problem that affects public health, affects individual. It's also costly. And I think there was an analysis. One that comes to my mind was presented in 2018. If you were to put a price tag on obesity, it's a $1.7 trillion. Endeavor.
Wow.
So it's a very expensive condition to have. You know, what's interesting, it's actually when you think about obesity, if you look at the data, it continues to increase in terms of the prevalence and incidence. And this is despite the fact that over the past, let's say, two decades, based on the more recent data, there was not significant change in the caloric intake or the physical activity levels. So there was at some point this decrease in physical activity. The trends were going down for both females and for women and men. And then there was more of a caloric intake, but now it's sort of fairly steady. But despite that steadiness, despite no significant change over the past 20 years, there's increase in obesity, which makes you question of what has changed.
What the heck's going on?
Exactly. That's one of the interesting research questions. And one of the things that our research is focused is using genomics and genetics as well as epigenetics tools to better understand arterial and vascular aging. But that's also interesting for obesity. It's like you have a set of genes when you're born, and there's certain expectation of how they will express. And that's how we develop certain conditions that are more or less genetically predisposed. What we've also learned through epigenetics is that there are external mechanisms that can turn on some genes and turn them off. And what it's been observed is that some of the environmental factors, some of the stressors, some of the chemicals, including some of the foods, they actually result in turning on the genes that are involved in metabolic pathways associated with slowing the metabolism and turning off the ones that are more associated with faster metabolism. So it's not only, simply saying being lazy and not eating healthy, which is regardless very important, food is medicine, but there are additional parameters that contribute to us seeing obesity on its rise. And as a result, cardiovascular disease.
Yeah. You know, I've done shows on weight loss, and once a long time ago, I even did a exercise weight loss set of programs on this show where I needed to lose some weight, and I invited listeners to join me. Part of the conversation we get in this is that there are people who say, I don't eat a lot. I exercise a ton, and I can't get a pound off. And I can't, I wind up gaining weight. And there's so much among those folks, there is a lot of frustration and sort of anger because of the way they are sometimes treated.
Yeah, that's what I see in my clinic as well. I'm part of the cardiovascular prevention program, and frequently we talk about how to optimize cardiovascular health and body mass index, or BMI. That's current measure of how we identify someone who's overweight and someone who has obesity, which we can talk about has its limitations. But there frequently you hear frustrations from people who do their best. They're trying to eat salads, more greens. They're watching what is their saturated fat. They're trying to go to gym, and they're trying, in other words, their best. And, just to use this time and emphasize that American Heart Association recommends about 150, and more recent data, 200 minutes per week of physical activity, which is about 40, 45 minutes a day, five times a week. It could be longer stretches if, for instance, your work schedule doesn't allow you, that you would do like a weekend warrior. That all has substantial cardiovascular benefits, and goes without saying, even if you are not able to lose your weight, still continue doing that, because long-term this commitment does improve your vascular aging processes. It's not only about the number of that, what BMI looks like, but also trying to have that healthy BMI with reduced number of cardiovascular events. And if you are following that right diet and physical activity routine, you are on the right track. But you're so right that there's a lot of frustration when people come and they say that, the whole year I've been working on and working out, and I'm still not really moving. There's not significant change. Sometimes there's still room to improve. Sometimes it's good to talk with a dietitian, with a nutritionist, with someone who can provide a little bit of an input and be a little bit more personalized. But what I think where we're going with a lot of discoveries in the future, you know, with transcriptomics and proteomics, is that it will be more personalized in terms of to your metabolism, because there's, in a way, common denominator of what we recommend, right? We recommend usually two dietary patterns, such as Mediterranean diet, that's been shown in a randomized clinical trial to improve cardiovascular outcomes, saturated with olive oil, it is enriched with nuts, fish, fruits and vegetables, and another one is plant-based diet that's been shown to also have a number of positive clinical outcomes, including in the cancer world. We are not necessarily individualizing those approaches. It's fairly generalized if you think about it. And it's not necessarily ideal because everyone's metabolism is different. And the way that we process eggs, let's say, I'm seeing patients in my lipid clinic who have high cholesterol. And they frequently ask, well, what should I do with eggs? How many eggs should I take? Or should I just stop? Because there was all this notion that you shouldn't be having any egg yolks and no butter. Or maybe now it's okay to have it. So there are a lot of questions usually. And you give the recommendations based on your best knowledge, but it's not necessarily individualized based on how your body operates. And I think that's where we're heading to learn more about how our body operates.
You mentioned a body mass index of 30 or 27 to 30. And I think that's when people become eligible for that GLP-1. If they have a what is a body mass index of 30? I mean, how's that measured? What does it look like?
Yeah, it's simply the calculator is just your height and weight. So anyone can do it at home, knowing your it's a ratio and it's easy to estimate. Usually you need to use kilos and meters instead of pounds and inches. So that's the only caveat. otherwise, yes, for like you've been mentioning, 30 kilograms per meter squared, BMI above that threshold is considered to be obesity for adults based on WHO, World Health Organization, and then overweight is considered to be above 27. And, you know, if you look at the risk curves in terms of cardiovascular disease, there's fluctuation. It does gradually increase starting at around BMI of 25, then going further 27 and 30 and above. So there's association with your weight and with the cardiovascular outcomes.
Talking today with Dr. Maya Safarova, cardiologist with Froedtert and the Medical College of Wisconsin. We're taking a look at weight loss, protecting your heart. We're looking at some of the GLP medications, like Wegovy and Ozempic, that are in use, and taking a look at what are the upsides and maybe what are some of the potential downsides to taking these drugs. Maybe you're taking one right now, or maybe you wish you could take one. Give us a call, the number 800-642-1234, or you could email us, the email address, talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you with us today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here talking with Dr. Maya Safarova, a cardiologist with Froedtert of the Medical College of Wisconsin. Great to have her with us as we talk about these GLP medications, weight loss, your heart, and hope you'll join in with your questions and comments as we move along. I did want to mention the GLP drugs now have become available in pill form, and previously, of course, the medications were home-administered injections. And how do you think this pill form will affect how many people maybe seek out these medications?
Yeah, when it comes to a choice, injectable or a pill, it's certainly, I would say, vast majority will say that having a pill is more appealing, just that you don't need to think about administering. But as of now, for this class of medications, I would say the bioavailability for injectables is much better. It's close to 100% as compared to pill form, when you need to have a higher concentration When you look at them head to head in terms of comparison, you see more prominent hemoglobin A1C or glycated hemoglobin, which is a measure of glucose metabolism over the course of 2 to 3 months, reduction in that parameter. So you have better glucose control. And importantly, you have more predictable and better weight loss. And it's more substantial as compared to the pill form as of now. It might change, but as of now, I would say that when I have those conversations, just focusing on what type of medications we should be choosing, injectables would be probably prioritized compared to the pill form. The pill form, the example would be Rybelsus, as you know, that was approved for type 2 diabetes in 2019. So it's been, and in general, these medications, by the way, I think that's one of the myths that they're still experimental. They've been out there for quite some time, and clinical trials, phase 3 clinical trials have been out for a decade, 2016, actually 2026, we're celebrating 10 years of having outcome data for these medications. But with pills, I think another important, clinically important aspect is that you have to be fairly strict with timing. So you take it at around the same time in the morning, and you have to be fasting, and then you take your meal about 30 minutes afterwards. So it's also fairly particular about how you take it compared to the injectable.
Well, and you know, mostly we hear about it in these drugs and medications in relation to weight loss right now, but it also. I mean, they were originally designed for something else, weren't they?
Yeah, that's correct. They were for type 2 diabetes. That was the intention. And that makes sense because that's GLP-1 receptor agonist. That's what they are intended to do. But what we've learned, and we continue to learn, there's actually a lot of ongoing research and still a lot of ongoing interest in this class. And again, that's a nutrient-stimulated hormones. The GLP-1 receptors express quite widely in our body. That includes kidneys. And that's why we see some kidney outcome data. That includes vessels. That's why it's interesting from standpoint of arterial aging. That includes heart. And that's particular of interest to cardiologists. And that's how cardiologists are now into this, discussing this class of medications in order to improve cardiometabolic health. And initially, trials were focusing on patients with established cardiovascular disease, for instance, someone who had a heart attack, acute coronary syndrome, and type 2 diabetes. And then as the signal was showing that, oh, there's benefit also in those who don't have type 2 diabetes, so there are additional, if you will, pleiotropic effects, effects that we were not expecting from these medications. There were more trials and trials that were focusing on those with established atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease, heart attacks and strokes, without diabetes, and then those who are at risk for heart disease. So even wider patient category, wider category of those who would be eligible to derive benefits from this class of medications.
Yeah. Well, if you're overweight and you take Ozempic, let's say, and you lose a significant amount of weight, my guess would be that's going to lower or decrease your risk of heart disease.
Yes. So weight reduction, very true, Larry, very true. Weight reduction, granted, you know, we talked about BMI being sort of flawed, because the height and weight description does not really tell you, is it your muscle weight? Is it your visceral fat? So what we are mostly hoping to see is visceral fat reduction as part of the overall orchestra of how we are reducing cardiovascular risk. Through that mechanism, including other metabolic pathways, I would say that the current average statistics, what we're seeing is reduction in heart attacks, for instance, that could be non-fatal heart attacks by about 10%, reduction in cardiovascular death by about 15%, heart failure reduction by about up to 20%. I think one of the kidney outcome is reduction in kidney outcome data by about 15 to 18%. But what I find interesting is that these medications were also showing to reduce all-cause mortality. In some of the trials, it was up to 20%, 19%, wow. which just overall suggests, like, what would be your interpretation, that they improve your overall health. It's quite hard. There are not a lot of interventions that can improve and reduce your overall all-cause mortality. That's quite impressive.
Well, we have we had some phone problems earlier, but they're resolved now. We have a number of people to visit with you. Let's go to Julie in Minocqua first. Julie, hi.
Hi there. How are you?
Great. Appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
I'm calling on behalf of my husband, who has a hearing deficit. He has, and we're actually patients at Cratered, and have been trying to get qualified for the Ozempic class drugs for quite a while. His body mass index is 39. He's pre-diabetic. He has mild COPD and sleep apnea. But for some reason, it seems because he's not diabetic that he doesn't qualify. And we're just struggling with
That.
Okay. Yeah.
Julie, thanks a lot for calling. It raises an interesting point here.
Yeah, Julie, thank you for your question and thank you for calling. Thank you for being seen at Fratert. You know, that is unfortunately a struggle indeed, and I cannot tell you how frequently we have to write letters of medical necessity, how frequently. So these medications, as you know, they don't have generics. They have to go through a process called prior authorization. As of now, that's how in our healthcare system we get insurance to cover. There's always a pathway of out of pocket, which is incredibly costly and hard to reach. But with to get insurance approval, it does take a lot of effort. I must note that it's been a little easier, maybe more recently. I think with my patients, when I see them, we can have initial maybe not positive outcome. We appeal, we try a different one. We try to see what is on the plan. We try to see what else can be added in terms of the description of the clinical scenario. We try to have peer-to-peer conversation. So it over time, I feel like it will get better and better. If you think about particularly, I think you mentioned Zepbound, right? That's what you were working on, tirzepatide. So tirzepatide for the indication of obstructive sleep apnea, moderate to severe, that's now an indication, an individual who has elevated BMI in the range of obesity has been approved by the FDA in 2024. There's frequently a lag between how easy it is to get insurance approval, how fast they get on the plan from the time that FDA approves it. And it does require a lot of push from the care team. And even sometimes with a push, it doesn't. It's strange that you have to talk about it, that you have to have your physicians and healthcare team to push for something when something is indicated. And, you know, we're singing songs about how great they are in our armamentarium to have to reduce cardiovascular outcomes. But it is a challenge. It is a true challenge. And I know that a lot of physicians would just give up and say that, you know, that's just not feasible. You can't spend so much time on the phone, like in 30 minutes, an hour, just trying to convince someone that this is the right patient, like for weight management, for instance, and that will really improve their cardiovascular health, that will help with their knee problems. They might not need an expensive knee surgery, as an example, and overall they will be more physically active. And there are a lot of struggle there. And I think what I would wish, Julie, is that just maintain patience and perseverance and keep working in that direction with the team. You know, if they have challenges, we are certainly happy to see you in our clinic and go over more in details of what can be done. But Zepbound is one. And just to mention, Larry, I know you have another question. There's also Mounjaro. So there are a number of medications we should at some point just discuss to make sure that our listeners know. The most frequent one, you know, we talked about Ozempic. There's also liraglutide. But depending on the indications, for instance, Ozempic has been approved for type 2 diabetes since 2017. When we talk about semaglutide for the indication of weight loss, one has to recognize that's a different concentration also in terms of the medication. So for the weight loss, it is Wegovy, and it's been approved since 2021. Wegovy now is approved also for cardiovascular risk reduction, some of the providers may want to have that from the FDA webpage. They have a nice description of who's eligible. Sometimes I add clinical trial data to my notes to just sort of like supportive evidence of why we're talking about Wegovy. This has been approved since March 2024, actually March 8th, 2024, almost exactly 2 years. Now, more recently, in patients who have been diagnosed with quote-unquote fatty liver disease or recent appropriate diagnosis is metabolic-associated liver disease or MAFLD or MASH, it's been approved since August 2025. So even in this patient population, Wegovy could be used. So Wegovy and Ozempic, these are the two when it comes to semaglutide. For tirzepatide, which is a combination drug, GLP-1, remember we talked at the beginning, and GIP. So the Zepbound has been approved as a chronic weight management medication in 2023 when there are additional risk factors, and that could be, for instance, you have elevated blood pressure or you have elevated cholesterol. And then since 2024, Zepbound, as I mentioned, approved for obstructive sleep apnea. Now, the second medication that also has a tirzepatide as its main active ingredient is Mounjaro. And Mounjaro has been approved for glucose metabolism or sugar management in type 2 diabetes.
You know, I was looking at some of the figures this morning some of the cost, let's put it that way. So there was one GLP-1 medication that, for insurance purposes, it was like at around $1,300 a month. But then I noted also, if you paid out of your own pocket, it was $300 to $500 a month. And I thought, why the heck isn't the insurance side of it at, I understand there's paperwork and all of that, but that's a like $800 difference. That doesn't make any, well, it makes sense if you got stock in the company, that's for sure. And I believe me, I wish I had bought stock in Wegovy and Ozempic about 20 years ago or 10 years ago even. I don't understand how there can be an $800 difference or more between paying it out of your own pocket, which, believe me, $300 to $500 a month is no small amount. But why is it $1,300 versus $500?
Oh, Larry. Well, full disclosure, I also don't have any stocks. And, mostly what I do is really research, translating research into clinical practice. And I wish I had an answer. It just beyond, I'm more at the front line of implementing rather than making policies. And I think what we lack is transparency in understanding how those costs are being made. And end users, as providers, and those who use them for indications, I think that advocacy at the state level, moving further to federal level, is something that is urgently needed. Yeah. You know, we identify the problem. We know that there is epidemic. We know that there is a gap in management. We understand that this is not just being lazy and hungry and snacking. We understand that there is more in-depth problems. But that the pricing aspect related, and it's not only GLP-1 problem, it just may be more recognized because they're widely used or widely there's more interest in, because I see in my clinic a spectrum of individuals who are coming, spectrum of enthusiasm. There are those who are coming and they really know what they need, what they want. And then those who are very hesitant to start, and there are aspects like why they are hesitant. But that is true for imaging. That is true for other medications, that there's a gap between what is being billed to insurance and gap between what you might be paying out of pocket. But the price that you were mentioning today, for instance, it's still much better than it was a few years ago. Our institution was among early adopters of GLP-1s. And I remember times when days when it was above 1800. And, you know, the seeing that the cost is coming down is already sort of making you feel better, but I just don't have a good answer. And I think talking about it, the fact that we're talking about it and raising awareness, maybe it will reach ears of those who are policymakers and realize how important it is. Maybe it will be, this will be something that will generate and add to conversation at a level where the decisions are actually made, and that patients will have access to treatments that are, you know, I'm going to use the word of life-saving treatments.
Let's take some, Julie, again, thank you for calling, Julie. Eric in Middleton has been waiting a bit. Eric, thank you for waiting. What's on your mind?
Thank you. Yeah, I have a decision to make about going on Ozempic. I have type 2 diabetes. My BMI is about 29. I weight train and do not present as obese because of that. I probably could lose about 12 pounds, but what should I consider when making a decision about going on Ozempic? And I'm thinking about the negatives. I've heard about a loss of muscle mass and a loss of motivation to exercise.
Yeah.
What
good.
Should I consider?
Good question, Eric. What about it, Dr. Safarova?
That's awesome, Eric. Thank you. I'm glad you're opening up, because it's the whole box of Pandora. I think, you know, I mentioned earlier that there's a spectrum of individuals who, a spectrum of enthusiasm who come, who know what and how, and those who sort of are more, okay, tell me more about why we should be thinking about it. And, you know, I'm going to start with, for semaglutide, for instance, contraindications. It's important to know the range of situations where you shouldn't be thinking about these medications. So personal or family history, personal family history of so-called medullary thyroid carcinoma. So those who have thyroid cancer would have issues on this medication, negative outcomes. So that's why this takes away Ozempic. There's a condition called MED2. It's fairly rare, but it's important to make sure that an individual doesn't have a MED2. MED2 stands for multiple endocrine neoplasia syndrome, type 2. And then there's certainly those who have allergies to semaglutide, which you won't discover up until you have the medication. But I would say those two, I want to take it right away. They are fairly rare, but if it is something to be considered, especially if there's family history, no, personal history should be still considered. Now, then you take it to the next level and you think, okay, what are the indications? The indications we talked about, managing the weight and expectations. It's a long-term treatment. It's a commitment. That's another actually topic in terms of how to come out, if it's possible to come out, what is the data in terms of trying to wean off, how long can we do it, just for half a year and stop, or you will regain weight. At present, when you start, you're thinking about long-term commitment. Long-term commitment to something that's injectable and having a certain level of comfort to administer. For instance, a person who has significant tremors, that might be a challenge. So one has to look for someone who will administer. Granted, it's easy to administer. Usually, if we're talking about FDA-approved formulations, they're coming as a pen. So it's not a vial that you need to pull and inject. It's a pen, and it's fairly straightforward to inject. There's site injection reaction, which is what is typically seen with any injectable medication, including for the medications that are cholesterol management. And then there are also a component of you know, you hear a lot of success stories of individuals starting on a medication, tolerating it fairly well, and losing weight that is predominantly visceral weight of 80 pounds plus minus. But there are also individuals who are not able to tolerate one or another formulation because of the so-called gastrointestinal symptoms. And nausea and vomiting are not trivial. I do have some patients who tell me that, you know what, I will maintain, but I know that when I give myself an injection, that 24 to 48 hours, I'm not necessarily a very functional individual. It also depends on your work of line. You know, there's some people for whom it's very important to be focused and there's just no opportunity for them to negotiate it. You can always plan on the weekend or whatever the day off you have. But I think when you start, that's also important to keep in mind that one can develop those side effects. Diarrhea. And if you look at the clinical trial data, for instance, the most, one of the, well, maybe it has been updated, but in 2023, there was a New England Journal paper on the trial was SELECT trial and was looking into individuals with cardiovascular risk without diabetes. GI side effects were the leading ones. Otherwise, in comparison to placebo, there was no significant signal so far that makes us concerned. They've been out there for quite some time. One has still to remain vigilant when it comes to the patient and to the physician. We're still talking about maybe one generation, 20 years, maybe more than 20 years, but about one up to generation of individuals who are being treated. So there's still data to be accumulated, and one has to keep an open mind and register any potential hints that are concerning. But I would say that there are ways for an individual, I also want to mention that for our listeners, through the FDA website to report side effects, not just through your physician. You certainly have to notify the prescriber, but to notify about the side effects. And that's one of the critical differentiating aspects probably with the compounded drug. As you know, there's also a compounded option. That compounded options are not being overseen, so the efficacy safety is always questionable. There's a BeSafe Rx website, which is a good source for online pharmacy information and also can guide you in some of those questions related to side effects. So I would say that one of the major aspects would be knowing that this is a long-term treatment, knowing that the timing when you take the medication in comparison to the food intake, modifying your diet if appropriate in terms of how I would say greasy it is, the content of that meal that you take the day of injection is important. And you also mentioned an important component of muscle loss. So there is currently understanding that some individuals lose not only visceral fat, but also muscle. And I think there's ongoing work in this direction. There was just recently this year a publication that came on phase two clinical trial. It was published in Nature. The medication is called Bimagrumab. Bimagrumab is it's an antibody that targets type 2 activin receptor. And this study particular, in a small number of patients, was randomized clinical trial, but it was a small number of patients. When they combined this Bimagrumab, with semaglutide and versus monotherapy semaglutide. And they were shown that they showed that there is a substantial reduction in body weight, and the muscle weight was not necessarily affected. So there are ways how in the future we'll be able to overcome, and it's very closely coming, but it's true that one has to monitor it. And in clinical practice, unfortunately, we're not as good in identifying that visceral fat. There are ways how with the CAT scan, you can measure it actually physically. Mostly what you will see in the doctor's office, there's measurement of the neck circumference and then the waist circumference, in addition to BMI, body mass index. But it's not the best way how we would identify that differentiate visceral fat. I think with better technology, we'll be also better at monitoring and having that surveillance.
Yeah. So, and Eric's a weightlifter, so there's that. I think there some of the information you provide, well, all of it, but that in particular might have perked his interest a bit with the other pills. Thank you again, Eric. Dot in Chippewa Falls, it's your turn. Hi, Dot. Oh, I think we lost Dot. Well, in that case, a quick reminder here, we're talking with Dr. Maya Safarova, cardiologist with Frederick and the Medical College of Wisconsin. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Thanks for joining in today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Dr. Maya Safarova, cardiologist with Frederick and the Medical College of Wisconsin, as we look at the GLP-1 medications for weight loss and probably relating to heart as well. And Denise in Madison has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Denise.
Hi, Larry and doctor. My question has to do with the relationship or use of these medications in children. There has been, as we all know, a rise in childhood obesity over the last however many years. And, have there been any clinical trials? Is there any indication for their use? And at what point in time do pediatricians start looking at something like a BMI for children?
Yeah. Thanks for calling, Denise.
Yeah, Denise, thank you for this question. And, overall, I think our goal in cardiovascular prevention and in general in preventive world should be switched to more focusing on actually youth, because that's where we gain the most benefit. If we address risk factors, we talk about family history and possibility of disease development early in life. Body mass index being one of those measurements that allows to identify those at risk. Now, my disclosure is that I'm an adult cardiologist, but what I can share in the pediatric world is that GLP-1 receptor agonists such as liraglutide and semaglutide have been approved for children age 12 years and above. Type 2 diabetes established is one of the indications which as many of you might know, might not manifest as early as 12 years old, and usually maybe doesn't. And then those with elevated BMI. So they're FDA approved. Now, I know for pediatricians, it is always a challenge to consider initiation of pharmacotherapies in young individuals for risk factor control, including for cholesterol, just because you are thinking that this is more towards adult world. I think more data and awareness is what will help. We just talked that it's not only about the diet and not only about physical activity, which goes without saying. It's important to implement. It's important to be focused. And the causes of obesity are versatile, from including genetics. But at some point, you I think having maybe more data saying that intervening early is beneficial is what will convince a wider range of pediatrician to implement it. Like example would be with cholesterol. The recommendation currently is for screening 9 to 11 years that you would do your cholesterol screening. And depending on the situation, start therapies at the age of 8 years old, for instance, depending on the situation and genetics, could be early, could be later. But that in the world of cholesterol, we have data that shows long-term over more than two generations that early initiations of cholesterol treatment reduces your risk of heart attacks, strokes, need for stents and bypass surgery. I think that's what we need in the pediatric world of managing diabetes and obesity. And that there's still the data is limited on the long-term effects of these drugs on bone growth and hormone levels and puberty. And this is probably the main concern that my colleagues would bring. I think maybe at some point bringing a pediatrician on board and would be interesting to have that debate and just interesting to know what they would opt, like bariatric surgery versus pharmacological therapy versus non-pharmacological interventions and when they would intervene on that curve. For me, they come and see me usually starting at the age of 20. Sometimes it's 18 years of age, depending on the pathology, but mostly it's 20 years old. And at that age, it's easier to have this conversation without necessarily taking into account additional questions of their development.
Yeah. Denise, thank you. Margaret has a daughter who is at least 100 pounds overweight. Now, this may be an older daughter. I'm not sure. She is disabled and on Medicaid. Are there any programs or ways for her to get the medication for free or reduce cost?
Yes, there's actually there are grants. And in our institution, every institution has their own program in terms of how they set it up. I can speak for our institution. Our program involves pharmacists. There's a provider, there's a physician with knowledge of indications, contraindications, how to manage. There's a dietitian, and there's a pharmacist. And we work closely together, trying to identify ways how to increase accessibility. You know, we spent quite some time today, I think, talking about the issues with the access. But for certain individuals, there are ways how we help them to get so-called grant support when for a period of time they will be getting certain medications for it's not free, certainly. I don't think there's, unfortunately, in this world anything free, but it's through mechanisms where we're supporting them that they would be able to start. And then further, depending on the situation with maintenance, could be renewed or there are other ways. But the answer is yes, there are ways, and it's all individual, depends on income, depends on clinical scenario and situation. And my hope is that, again, there will be more ways how on the state level we will increase the accessibility to both these programs as well as to medications.
Ellie in Madison had emailed us and wonders, she's noticed that the people in the GLP commercials are getting skinnier and is afraid that the prevalence, is harming body image, especially for young girls. In the last 30 seconds, a comment on that?
Gosh, that's not a 30-second conversation, the body image. That is, you know, the interpretation, and it certainly has to be part of the conversation, especially with younger individuals during your visit with a doctor. I think the commercials don't really take into account that aspect. They're more trying to leverage more interest. But when you have that conversation with a doctor, it's important to go over the details. And I agree. That is raising a whole another issue of mental health.
Well, Dr. Safarova, I thank you so much. Will you come back and be with us again? I'd love to have you back. We haven't covered everything that I wanted to cover.
Thank you. I would love to. And I would love you to talk about cholesterol. If there's any interest among listeners about lipoprotein(a), about genetic cholesterol, I think there's so much to cover. And it's just an ability to talk through things and increase awareness is, to me, is one of the rewarding aspects of our job. And
thank you very much, Dr. Maya Safarova, cardiologist with Froedtert and the Medical College of Wisconsin. Coming up next, Dr. Zorba Pastor, our guest. Thanks so much for joining us today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. We're going to start by taking a look at public health in Wisconsin with our next guest, Dr. Zorba Pastor. Zorba, retired physician, author, former host of our nationally syndicated WPR show, Zorba Pastor on Your Health. And he has a pretty new podcast.
Yeah, Stay Well with Dr. Zorba Pastor. And that's the name of the podcast. Anyone who looks at podcasts, Apple, Amazon, wherever they'll find it. And I'll tell you, the Stay Well with Dr. Zorba Pastor, we've got, you know, a couple of 100,000 downloads at this point. So things are going really well.
I'm glad to hear that.
Yeah, going really well.
So what do they do to get to it?
Well, they go to wherever. First of all, if you've never, you know, gone to a podcast, just stop any teenager on the street or young adult and you say, how do I go to a podcast? And they open up wherever they get podcasts, either on their, inevitably it's on your phone.
Yeah.
So usually it's on the Apple phone. All you do is put in podcast, put my name in, Dr. Zorba Pastor, and you'll download it. You can subscribe to it. It comes out weekly. It's a 20, 25-minute podcast. Then we've got quick updates whenever anything comes out of Washington. I usually have a comment on it, and then we move on from there. But the real issue is good curated medical information, just like I did for almost 35 years on Wisconsin Public Radio, taking medical information, putting it into an entertaining, digestible form so that people can understand it and figure it out for themselves.
And you do that very, very well. And
if you
have a question or comment for Dr. Zorba, you could join in to the number 800-642-1234. Email to talk at WPR.org. Love to hear from you. Last week, Governor Evers announced his administration's desire to join the Food is Medicine movement. What's that all about?
Well, first of all, you know, if we look at food and we look at it in a broad way, which is rather interesting, we want to make sure that we eat the right stuff. So you've got ultra-processed foods. You sort of have four broad categories of food. You have no processed food, eat an apple. You have minimally processed foods, and we'll say take an onion and you saute it, we'll say in butter, olive oil. That's minimally processed. And then you've got the ultra-processed foods where there's so many things on the label that you can't even read it, let alone pronounce it. And there's so many ultra-processed foods out there because they become easy and convenient. You put it in the microwave, you eat it. And the fact is, these foods are not good for us. And so the food is medicine idea is, how do we now think of it as medicine and good for our health? The other problem is more than half of our food dollar now is spent with prepared food. So in Oregon, my small town outside of Madison, I counted the other day, and there are more than 25 places where you can get prepared food in this small town outside of Madison. And that includes Quick Trip, you know, the grocery store at Hy-Vee and everywhere else. And that's because people are not cooking for themselves. And if you cook for yourself, you know what's going in, and good food means you're going to stay healthy.
Makes a lot of sense to me. You know what? Dot in Chippewa Falls has something for us. Let's go there.
Oh, thank you so much. First of all, are you familiar with Dr. Phil's recipe? He worked with Dr. Oz. It is called Sugar Harmony. It is all natural, supposed to kill parasites in the pancreas. Uh-huh. And it supports healthy blood sugar for people with type 2 diabetes, because the root cause apparently is parasites.
Mm-hmm.
And his medicine kills the parasites.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, there are no parasites in your pancreas. And so when they actually say there are parasites in the pancreas, it's rubbish. There's no scientific evidence for that at all. And a lot of you bring up a really good point. There's a lot of rubbish out there that doesn't make sense that people then buy and spend their money on when really the governor's idea is food is medicine means go back to food. Go to your grocery store. Plentiful fruits and vegetables. 5 servings. Not a lot. There's not a lot of serving. The brighter the vegetable, the better the micronutrients in that vegetable. So a colorful plate filled with lots of vegetables. Olive oil on a salad is good, of course. If you're going to have a protein, the best protein, of course, is fish protein. That's really food is medicine. And the other stuff is save your money. Don't spend it on what Dr. Phil says and others says. And that's why listening to public radio is a great way to get that information. And that's what we're doing on the Larry Mueller Show. And actually, this is what I like to talk about on my podcast, Stay Well with Dr. Zorba Pastor. There's so much information on. It's very difficult sometimes to, sift and winnow the way we do things in Wisconsin.
Yeah. Dot, thank you for calling. Thank you. Appreciate it. Dennis and Custer has something. Let's go there.
Yes, Dr. Zorba, I have a friend that I'm watching die in front of my eyes.
Uh-huh.
Oh, 6 months ago, he couldn't keep food down, so mm-hmm. he's throwing up this food. And, of course, this continued for 6 months. Mm-hmm. He's right now lost 100 pounds.
Wow.
He did have a mm-hmm. CAT scan mm-hmm. and a probe mm-hmm. in the stomach, which took some biopsies, 5 of them. They all mm-hmm. came back negative.
Oh, uh-huh.
The CAT scan indicated thickening of the walls or leathery walls of the stomach.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And he's tried. Now, I think what he needs, but he won't spend the money or go, is a PET scan. Mm-hmm. If that could tell more definitively mm-hmm. what's going on. But he's down to about 140 pounds from 240. Uh-huh.
Wow.
And wow. I just don't know what to do with him.
Well, my suggestion in situations like that is not to do a PET scan, but to get a second opinion. I mean, we kind of don't just image because that may give us the answer. And PET scans are really good for certain things, such as cancer, to determine if it's somewhere else. But certainly in a situation like that where you lose that much weight, getting a second opinion, I usually recommend getting a second opinion at least 100 miles away from you. Because you want to get a physician that doesn't necessarily know the group or the physician that you're working in, and then you're more likely to get a good objective, second opinion. And, University of Wisconsin, Mayo Clinic, great places in the Midwest to get a second opinion to find out what's going on. Something's going on, 100 pounds, a lot of weight, that's what he needs.
Boy, oh boy, I guess so. Dennis, thank you very much for calling. About a third of, I think, of our Wisconsin adults have high blood pressure.
Right.
About 1 million of them are pre-diabetic. How do you make that connection between health and food to make more Wisconsinites healthier?
Well, first of all, one of the issues, we have in the state, I always make a joke that, when you cross the border from Illinois, the governor gives you 20 pounds and then you get an extra 2 pounds benefit a year. But we are a hefty state. So one of the ways is really begin to look at your food intake. And I often recommend to people, the way you get a handle on that is for 3 days, don't look anything up, just write down everything that you're eating. That's all. Everything that you're treating. And then 3 days later, go to Google it, just put in, had this, had that, and the number of calories, and you will be surprised at where your calories are coming from. So, for instance, if you go to Subway, if I ask people, what do you think the most caloric sandwich at Subway is, they usually say the meatball, but in fact, it's the tuna, because tuna has mayonnaise. And that's where all the calories come from. And you think, oh, tuna, it's good, it's fish, which is true, but it's got a bunch of mayonnaise. And if we were just to cut down 200 calories a day, 150, 200 calories a day, that can make a big difference. And once again, there are a lot of other things we can do in terms of doing that. If you look at liquid calories, if you have 20 ounces of a Coke, you're getting 20 teaspoons of sugar. that's a lot of sugar. Nobody would have 20 sugar cubes. So you don't want to drink your calories. You want to eat your calories. You want to make them wholesome. You want to make them calories that are good. The best diet is the Mediterranean diet. And people will often say to me, what do you mean? Is the Mediterranean diet go? You can look it up on Wikipedia. There are a number of books, Mediterranean Diet for Beginners, that you can get on Amazon. And just begin to follow what they do around the Mediterranean Sea. You will lose weight and you will be healthier.
As you were talking, I was thinking about a couple of, one research project, and this is years back, where they had people record what they ate, and this was going to be over, I forget the period of time. Anyway, they had to write it all down, what they ate, and then they had to come in and stay in the whatever,
in
wherever,
the lab.
In the lab, and they were then fed what they said they ate. And they all gained weight. Because
they all gained weight. It's very funny. Well,
it goes to, I mean, I don't forget about that M&M that you
ate. That's right. Because it's not that easy. It's not that easy to lose weight. So from a high blood pressure point of view, cutting down on salt, not getting rid of it because it's really hard to get rid of it, makes a difference. Cutting down on alcohol. You know, we're the number one state in the country when it comes to binge drinking, which is, you know, really something. And we drink too much alcohol, though there's a whole movement, especially among young people, to have less and less alcohol. And I just got back from a vacation, and you look at menus in restaurants now, and part of the menu will often say mocktails. And that was never a thing. Look back 5 years ago, 3 years ago, 2 years ago. That was not in the menu because people are starting to think about alcohol. And that really is dropping alcohol, changing your eating habits, and, of course, exercising. That will lead you to a healthier life.
Cheryl in Berlin. Let's go there. Hi, Cheryl.
Yeah, hello. I'd like to know, do you think there's any real value in doing Tai Chi?
Oh, for sure. Tai Chi is great. Tai Chi is a good example of, you know, excellent exercise. When I think to my own, you know, I'm an old guy. I'm younger than you, Larry, but I'm an old guy. I'm 78, 78 and a half. And I think about what I used to do. I used to jog. I used to run. I used to do other things. Now my joints ache. And basically, I want to keep them limber. Tai Chi is great for balance. Like yoga, it's excellent for your joints. There is chair Tai Chi if you can't get around. And there is active Tai Chi. And Tai Chi is an excellent exercise at any age. And so the answer is yes. And exercise should be an important part of your staying well.
Cheryl, there you go. Thank you. Dan in La Crosse, your turn. Hi, Dan.
Hi. So I recently heard about you talking about fish being the best protein. And we really try hard with our family to get fish from a sustainable source. Mm-hmm. We also eat a lot of fish from our local waterways. And so is there any other concerns that you might have with, like, mercury or sustainability with that?
Oh,
and
sure.
I just like to add that we add a lot of red meat from lamb.
Mm-hmm.
And what your thoughts are, you know, comparing grass-fed lamb and beef in comparison to just regular store market beef.
Sure. So first of all, the mercury issue, you know, I would go, I don't know individual fish within Wisconsin that you're catching. There are mercury issues, and I would, you know, I would say go to the DNR website or Google mercury, Wisconsin fish. That's what I would do. And look at the recommendations because they basically change year by year or every other year. And I would look at it from that point of view. We know that salmon, especially sustainable salmon, is good. I like to get salmon that's farm-raised. I think it's okay. I like to get farm-raised salmon in the U.S. because then I know it follows certainly U.S. standards. So I like to see where it's sourced, where it comes from. Salmon is really good. Herring is great. Pickled herring is something I really love.
I do, too.
I like pickled herring. Yeah, especially in sour cream. Well, anyway, that's something else. And then sardines are excellent. Sardines that are openly sourced are really good. So those are things to really look at. Lamb is considered to be red meat. It's excellent. It's delicious. And like other red meat, you have to look at the fat from that. And once again, you know, we don't have to throw out the baby with the bathwater. We can say, I'm going to have red meat. I'm just not going to have it every day. You know, my mother, when she would make something to eat for an evening meal, she basically had red meat almost every night. It wasn't, sometimes it was lamb, sometimes, you know, it was skirt steak, sometimes it was Swiss steak, but whatever it is, she thought that red meat was an important part of eating. The fact is, no, but you can eat it. And so lamb is really good. But I don't think it's, it's different than beef when it comes to a cholesterol point of view. Despite the fact that if you look at the new food pyramid that comes out from RFK, sort of an upside down pyramid, he also put in that you should cook with beef tallow. And I thought, where do you buy beef tallow in Madison, Wisconsin? And the answer is, I haven't answered that yet. So,
Dan, thank you very much for calling. And by the way, those DNRs advisories are pretty good, and they even go down to the level of the kind of fish.
The kind of fish and where.
Yeah.
Within the state.
And where they are.
And we like to eat our fish. We like to locally source and eat our fish. Just look at the advisory. And the issue with the advisory really has a lot to do with pregnant women more than others. So pregnant women and growing children, those are really where the advisories are most important.
Dr. Zorba Pasta, our guest today. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Taking a look at the health of Wisconsin today with our guest, Dr. Zorba Pastor. His new podcast out there, Stay Well with Dr. Zorba Pastor. Questions for him or comments, the number 800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Cheryl in Iron Ridge, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Well, I had a little trick because of losing weight that works very well. I came from the family of we love pasta.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And as you know, pasta is very high in carbs.
Mm-hmm.
So I went and bought packages of frozen riced cauliflower.
Mm-hmm.
And now when I make a Greek dish instead of the rice, I use the cauliflower.
Excellent.
When I make an Italian dish, I use the frozen cauliflower. And you know what? It tastes wonderful.
It does.
And
yes.
It's filling.
Right. Yes. Rice cauliflower is excellent. It's just a good way to use, a vegetable that really is good for you. And then you're also avoiding too much pasta, too much in the way of carbohydrates. So good for you. Yes, it's excellent. And people can buy it pretty much anywhere, in any major grocery store. And a lot of small grocery stores will have it in the frozen food section. So, and you can make it yourself. Also, there are ways to make it yourself. But I've done that. I bought the frozen stuff. Easier.
It's easier.
Thank you. Thanks for the tip.
Back to beef tallow for a second. Brandy in Lake Mills called to share that the conscious carnivore on the west side of Madison
is true. Right.
You can buy quality beef tallow.
Yeah, right. Yeah, and they're really quality. They're a quality company. Thanks for letting us know. Letting me know.
The Wisconsin Department of Health Services is looking for funding and training for a state officer to oversee food as training activities.
Mm-hmm.
Are you familiar with that program?
I'm not familiar with it, and I'm not looking for a job, if that's what you're, that's what you're asking. But it's just a good example of we've got to have more training. So how much, when I went to medical school, now that's back in the 70s, how much nutrition training do you think we got?
Probably nothing.
That's right. We really didn't get anything. That with the dietitians, you know, they were over in another building. Really didn't get anything at all. You know, they were given lip service for that. And I think part of the governor's idea of food is medicine and something that we have to do, certainly within the medical, and we've discovered that over the last certainly 10 and 20 years, is that we've got to pay more attention to what goes into our mouth, because that ultimately is producing a better body. And that is incredibly important. And often go into your doctor's office and they say, how's your diet? We talk about it for maybe 30 seconds or a minute.
Yeah.
And that's about all that there is. So that's really not giving it it's not giving it the, it's giving it the short shrift, not giving it as much importance as it really needs.
Yeah. You can join in too. Number to call 800-642-1234 or email to talk at WPR.org. Yeah, I think that state officer, getting a state officer to oversee it, if that happens, Wisconsin would be one of 10 states participating in the Food as Medicine state officer program.
You know, part of this also has to do, recently reviewed some issues that have to do with SNAP, you know, food stamps, yeah. Supplemental, and looking at candy, soft drinks, and prepared desserts nationwide with SNAP. And that is roughly between 17% and 22% of the fund, of the money that goes into SNAP actually is what I would call sort of wasted calories. And so there's a movement among a number of states. Wisconsin right now at this moment is not part of that movement, to take those benefits and say, we want to use the SNAP benefits to encourage better eating. So why are we doing that for soft drinks, which are basically liquid Twinkies? But I think that's an important thing to people to realize, that when you have a soft drink, you're not really getting anything from it. It's a treat. When you were a kid, did you drink Coke and Pepsi very often?
No.
No. Wasn't it a treat?
It was
a treat. And it was treated as a treat, not something that we had at our meal. And I think that's important for everyone to think about.
Carlene in Brooklyn, Wisconsin. Your turn. Hi, Carlene.
Hi. This is a question for Dr. Zulk. I had a calcification score done like a year ago, and it was like 1,000.
Uh-huh. And this is a heart scan that you had? Is that what you meant?
Yeah. When I had to go in that machine,
right,
and it told you the score.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Right.
And so that's pretty high.
Yes, it is.
And I have
heart
disease on both sides,
yes,
of my family.
Right.
And so then they end up giving me a cardiac catheter done.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Good. Good thing to do following that, right? So they did catheterization,
right,
and look at the blood vessels around your heart.
Correct. And I have one that was 70%.
Okay.
And then the other three were like 20 and 30 and maybe 40.
Good.
Mm-hmm. And I always say to them about, I mean, they up my statin, mm-hmm, to at least, I used to take 20, now I take 40.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to go any further because I know statins have a lot of side effects.
Mm-hmm.
But I've asked them before about having the calcification score done again, but they seem to think like, what's it going to show?
Right, and that's exactly right. You don't repeat it again because the calcifications will still be there. That means you've got plaques. You've got some little plaques that are little kind of bumps in your coronary arteries, and they're calcified, so they will be there. They don't disappear. I want to get to the statin issue for just a minute. Statins are great drugs. They really are great drugs. And I think if you're going to take them, you really want to take the statin in the highest dose that is going to work for you. I don't think there's going to be any difference for most people with side effect of a 40 or 80, unless you start to get muscle pain, which is the most common thing with the statin. So some people only tolerate a small dose, some a medium dose, some a higher dose. But if you were my patient, we had a coronary artery catheterization like that, I would say, well, you ought to try to get your cholesterol with a statin and with diet, with exercise, no smoking, you know, do everything you can do from a lifestyle point of view, and then take a statin to the highest dose that you can tolerate. That would be my recommendation. And frankly, that has been shown to be the most important thing. So no reason to redo the calcification score because it's not going to change significantly.
Carlene, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. Roger emailed to say beef tallow is available in Costco. He also asked, what are your thoughts on the carnivore diet? Many doctors have YouTube channels about the healing benefits of a carnivore diet.
Many, yes. Well, there are many YouTube channels.
Yeah.
And I've got a podcast. stay well with Dr. Zorba, Pastor Zorba. I guess I just say that, but I'm not selling it. You know, well, first of all, you know, there are a lot of carnivore, you know, this is a paleo diet. This is what the ancestors used to eat. The fact is, if you look back when there were 1 million humans on the earth or 2 million on the earth, they were actually more vegetarians than anything else because basically killing animals was really very, very difficult. And when they did, it was a high protein diet for a while. And of course, once you kill the animal, it doesn't last very long because the protein then, you know, depreciates. I think any diet that is, you know, for a little while, if you're going to take it, but why would you want to limit other foods? I think the best diet is a food with a variety of foods in it. And that's, to me, the diet. And that's why I keep on going back to the Mediterranean diet as being the best diet. The other diets can be useful for short periods of time. People often lose weight to go on the Atkins diet. They can kickstart their weight loss with that. But if you look at the number of people who stay on carnivore diets or Atkins diet, and you look at them 2 years later, roughly 90 to 95% of them are no longer following that diet because it's too restrictive. Yeah. Once you make a diet restrictive, people stop doing it after a while. Kickstart it with that. Go back to the med diet.
The food as medicine movement is, I think, different a bit from the Make America Healthy Again movement that our Health and Human Services Secretary,
yes,
Robert,
right.
How is it different?
Well, first of all, the Food is Healthy movement is using a more scientifically based approach to scientifically based approach to making our society healthier. If you look at Make America Healthy Again, it's more of well, there are a few things. First of all, it's politics. You know, we don't have, I believe in science. I'm a doctor. I'm scientifically based. I want to take politics out of medicine. When I see patients, I don't ask them whether they're red or blue or green or yellow. I treat all patients exactly the same. And it's based on science. If you look at some of the stuff that's coming out of Washington, frankly, it's not based on science. Part of it is based on celebrities and what they think, and also I think people who have gone down the wrong way in terms of thinking about things in a non-scientific basis. That's kind of the best way to put it. Now, given that, the new food pyramid, which is upside down, was signed on to by the American Cardiology Association, by the American Pediatric Society, by a number of scientific societies, among other things, because of the limitation of fat and because of some of the other things that are in that new food pyramid. And also, looking at that, they're going after ultra-processed foods, which no one has ever done. And then look at something else. If you've ever looked at a food and you look at the number of calories, you take out, we'll say, candy or whatever it is, and tells the number of calories. Or you take out, we'll say, anything that's packaged. It'll tell you in big letters the number of calories. But in small letters, it'll tell you whether or not it's one or two servings. So you can pick up a package of pasta. It'll say 130 calories. And then look in smaller letters, it'll say two servings. So in other words, it's not 130 calories, it's 260 calories. Your mouth is wide open right now. You've never noticed that, have you?
I have noticed it. I was looking at
everything.
Candy bars.
Everything. Well, candy bars are, well, the big candy bars, the regular candy bars are roughly 210 calories. The big candy bars might say 210 calories, and then at small amounts, it'll say two servings.
Yeah.
So in other words,
who's going to eat a half?
Well, it's all because the large food companies, you know, basically were part of how they're labeling food. And basically, there is now a movement in Washington to go after that and saying this is not really teaching the public things that they should have. So I was recently, you know, the calories are listed for food. I was recently in the airport, in the Detroit airport, and I was looking for something to eat. And because they rearranged the calories much better, you can look and see the hamburger I was looking at was 900 calories. And I thought, that's half the calories I need for the day. Well, I can see that on the writing when I'm at a restaurant, but when I go and get packaged food, it's not obvious. We have to change that. And that's part of, I think, the movement that has to come out from the top down and from the bottom up.
Mm. Claire in Madison emailed to ask, and this goes back to the GLP-1 drugs. She's concerned these meds are coming across in the press as miracle cure-alls. Are we in danger of reducing the legitimate supply of drugs for people who really need them? And at the same time, are we encouraging potentially bogus knockoff industries?
Good questions. Well, first of all, one of the first drugs, Ozempic, when it first came out, which has been there for, well, the first drug in the GLP category was Victoza. And that has been around for about 20 years, but it did not cause any weight loss. Then Ozempic came out, caused weight loss. And of course, then it was difficult for the company Novo Nordisk to keep up with it. And the fact is, yes, a lot of money is now going into big pharma because the drugs are a big business and they cost a lot of money. On the other hand, the drugs are incredibly good. They're incredibly good for diabetes. They reduce the risk of heart disease and stroke. They really are, in many ways, miracle drugs. They really have a lot of application to them. And like the previous doctor that was talking about, you know, on Wisconsin Public Radio, there are side effects from these drugs long term, like any drug, that we have to be careful of. Side effects that may reduce the amount of muscle mass within your body and so on. Every drug has effects. Every drug has side effects. That's where you and your clinician have to sit down and say, is this drug right for me? And that's the best way for you to get information for you, because it should be tailored to you and your body.
Makes good sense. Dr. Zorba Pastor, our guest today, and you can join in. The number to call, 800-642-1234, or you could email us, the email address, talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Taking a look at your health today with Dr. Zorba Pastor. His podcast, Stay Well with Dr. Zorba Pastor. And Michael had emailed this back to Beef Tallow for a minute. It's a saturated fat. Why is saturated fat recommended as a healthy choice? Michael wants to know.
It's not a healthy choice. That's it. Why? Because of rubbish that's going on. It is not a healthy choice. Why is it recommended? Because RFK believes that it's a healthy choice. There is no scientific evidence behind it. I'm a doctor. I believe in science. That's kind of where it's at. I don't think we should start to use beef tallow. Now, you may want to use it for something that you're making a special dish. Don't get me wrong. You know, I'm going to go back. I want to make this wonderful, Ella's Deli used to have this wonderful cabbage soup that is made with beef. I just bought the beef today. It's got lots of fat in it. I'm going to make this delicious soup. But it's not my regular soup thing I'm going to have all the time. So,
you know, there you go.
There's your answer. Thank you.
Jim in River Falls. Your turn. Thank you for calling, Jim.
Hi, thanks for the program. I just want to make a comment first that soft drinks, I think, are incredibly harmful to the American populace. And I spent time in Mongolia, and people there eat, you know, high-fat diets, and but they're not eating the sugar content that we do. And you know, just my dentist also said, you know, pop is perfect for dentists because it just keeps sugar on your teeth all the time. So you get dental disease and obesity, and it's and plus all this plastic that goes into the waterways, you know, and microplastics. So that, I just want to make that comment. But I had a question about I had a blood clot in January, and they put me in Eliquis for 3 months, and I'm just about done with that. I'm just wondering, is it advisable to just stay on a baby aspirin? I'm very active, and it was kind of odd, I think. I mean, I'd been doing a lot of driving a couple weeks before I had this blood clot.
So you had a blood clot in your leg? Is that where you had it?
Yes, in my leg. Yeah, it was distal. You know, near my tibia.
Well, first of all, when you get a blood clot in the leg, then the recommendation is that you be on a blood thinner for 3 to 6 months, depending on what those circumstances are. The new blood thinners, the one warfarin, that's what we used for many, many years. The new one's called DOAX, direct oral anticoagulants. Much easier, better, easier to take. Whether or not you should be on an aspirin, whether or not it reduces that, something you ought to sit down with your doctor. I used to recommend baby aspirin for everyone. And then the data came out and said, no, that's really not, you know, there's no evidence that it always works for everybody in every time. So I don't know whether or not in your circumstance, whether or not that is going to make a difference or not make a difference. But I think this is a perfect example of messaging your doctor to find out whether or not your clinician, whether or not they think that will do anything. And if they say yes, then the secondary question is, where's the evidence? Because we're always looking for, you know, science. The thing about science is it's always changing. I mean, it's never exactly the same because evidence keeps on coming out. For a long time, we said everyone should be on a baby aspirin. Then the data came out and said, no, you should be on a baby aspirin if you have certain risk factors. I don't know if a baby aspirin in your circumstance would reduce the risk of another blood clot. That's kind of a question that would be difficult to answer without looking at your chart.
Jim, give a conversation. Just send a note.
Yeah, just send. Well, that's a nice thing about my chart. And, you know, my chart, which is epic, you know, in Madison. Nice thing is you can send a note to your clinician, and they'll send you an answer as to what it is. So you're not sitting on the phone talking. It's much better to send a note and ask, should I be on an aspirin on a, you know, on a daily basis since I had it? And especially if you're otherwise healthy and you don't know, why did it happen to me? And sometimes things just happen randomly, and sometimes they happen with purpose. So part of the issue is, did you have a workup to see if you had genetic predisposition to a blood clot? Because that's often part of the workup for somebody who has a blood clot in their leg for no specific reason, to see whether or not you have a genetic predisposition to that. And if so, then you go down that discussion with a hematologist to determine what the long-term recommendations would be. So a bit of work there to get an answer for you specifically.
Jim, thank you for calling. Dwayne in Verona, we'll turn to you now. Thank you for calling, Dwayne.
Thank you for taking the call. I'm in the process of reading No More Tears by Gardner Harris. I'm wondering if a good doctor might comment on that.
I've not read the book.
So I don't know. Dementia.
Could I please ask you to read it?
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you. I'll put it on my list, but thank you. So
the book is about this man's or this folk's journey with dementia.
Yeah. Well, my mother died of dementia in 1981. So my father kept her at home for 7 years. You know, she sort of fell off the cliff right away. I'm very familiar. She never really knew my kid's name. She didn't understand that. So I understand that on a personal basis. And my wife, Penny, had a memory loss as she was going downhill. So I find those books very difficult. I mean, yeah. I won't read them. I will not read the book about No More Tears because I've gone through that journey myself. And I think it's very important for people to understand that. And I think it's also important to look at books that you find that are useful for you, especially if you're dealing with problems like that. And it's important because often the people that you're close, that person is closest with, can then have burnout. And understanding the process can be extremely useful for that. And obviously, for this person, that was an extremely useful book. And I think it's good to put that out there for people to read and understand.
All right. Dwayne, thank you very much for calling. Kathy emailed to say her mother has blepharitis, B-L-E-P-H-A-R-I.
Oh, blepharitis.
Oh, is that what it
is?
Yeah,
if you can pronounce it, Larry, you can be a doctor.
Blepharitis, all right. I was trying to figure out how it was pronounced.
That was good, though. You know,
it looked like that's the way it should be pronounced. Blepharitis? Hey,
That's what English is all about. And that's an inflammation of the eyelids. Caused by lots of different things. Can be caused by an allergy. Can be caused by cosmetics. That's sort of one of the common things that can be causing it. Can be caused by infections and inflammation. And that's where you need to have, often family doctors, we often take care of blepharitis. And if we can't figure out what's going on, then we send them to an ophthalmologist to do that. Sometimes it's also caused by, if you look at your lower eyelid, it's sort of a gutter. And your eyes are tearing all the time. We've got to blink enough. Often we get blepharitis because we look at a screen and we don't blink, and because we get dry eyes. So often just moisturizing the eye can make a big difference, getting a liquid tear, which you can buy at the store, and any kind of a liquid tear, and then putting on a warm, moist mask. And what I recommend is you go and you get one of the liquid tear products. It doesn't have to say liquid tears. The ones that I'm using are slipping my mind. I can't remember which one I have right now at the house. But there are gels and there are drops, and you can ask your pharmacist which one they recommend. And then you buy a mask that you put in the microwave. In my case, it's for 24 seconds, and it's warm. You put the liquid tears in your eyes. Put the mask on top of it, let it sit there for 3 to 4 minutes. I do that when my coffee is brewing in the electric coffee pot. Do it twice a day, and that will often decrease blepharitis caused by dry eyes. And we don't realize as we get older, our skin gets dry, our eyes get dry, and when we look at a screen, which we all do, we don't blink as much. And so I'm not sure what her causes are, but many people who have blepharitis have dry eyes and just need to have a liquid tear type product.
You can join in too with your questions, 800-642-1234, or you could email to talk@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. In his recent State of the State address, Governor Evers also announced that Wisconsin will join the World Health Organization's Global Outbreak Alert and Response Network.
Yes. Yes, I think that's excellent. Well, if anyone who is aware of some of the politics that are going on in Washington is aware of the fact that we have stopped connecting with a lot of our global associates. They give us good information. And I think this then becomes a chance for the states to step up. I mean, we have 50 states, so we've got 50, every state has health commissions, every state has a health policy, every state looks at what they recommend for immunizations. Right now, the immunization recommendation out of Washington is the same as Denmark. Well, Denmark has fewer people than the state of Wisconsin, and we are a very broad-based country with lots of environments that are different than Denmark, so they've reduced the number of immunizations they recommend. I think they're completely wrong with that. And so I think the state health commissioners, like the state of Wisconsin, saying we're going to join with the World Health Organization, can step up and provide good information for the people in our state. So if the feds aren't doing it, then the states can do it. And maybe that's the reason why we have states that have their own health commissions, because they can say, well, we don't agree with the federal government, we're going to do our own. And let me tell you, the same is true, by the way, with a lot of organizations. If you look at ACOG, which is really the American College of Obstetrics and Gynecologists, and what they recommend in terms of screening for cervical cancer and breast cancer, and then you look at the American Cancer Society, what they recommend, and then you look at the U.S. Public Health Task Force, and they recommend, they're not all on the same page. They do many similar things, but they don't do them exactly the same. And that's where why you and your clinician can look at that and make the decision for you. But I love the fact that we're going to work as the state of Wisconsin, and I commend the governor for doing that.
Yeah, I think his direct quote was, public health isn't a partisan issue.
No, not at all. I mean, that's until recently, it was never a partisan issue. And frankly, it's not a partisan issue. It's not a partisan issue at all. And it's scientifically based. If you look at the fact that in 1900, the average age of death was 49. When FDR signed in Social Security, they signed it in at the age of 65. And most people were dead by the time they were 68. One of the reasons why Social Security is going bankrupt is we're living too damn long. And that's because we have good technology. And you remember when you were young, if somebody died in their 60s, you often said, well, they lived a good life.
Yeah.
Now, if somebody dies in your 60s, you go, what happened? And that's a difference because we have great technology. We have immunizations that have protected us from a variety of diseases. We've got statins. We treat high blood pressure. We don't smoke cigarettes. If we're good, we drink less alcohol, lots of lifestyle things. And all of these are scientifically based, and that's why we're living longer and we're healthier when we're older.
Darren from Kenosha emailed to ask if there is a difference between, this is, now we're getting into sugar here a little bit, mm-hmm. between real sugar and high fructose corn syrup.
Mm-hmm. Well, there may be a difference. It turns out high fructose corn syrup is associated, among other things, with gout. And beet sugar does not appear to be associated with gout. So there may be something about high fructose corn syrup. He's got a very good idea. That may be something that actually even addicts us to our sweet tooth. I don't really know, but it is definitely a different sugar product. It's not exactly the same. If you look at the benzene rings that are associated with that, it's an organic product. And so that product may be different. Among other things, there may be a difference in taste. You know, so if you go out to soft drinks, if you look at Coca-Cola, some of it will say made with real sugar. But high fructose corn syrup is easier to manufacture, and that's why it really has taken over. And yes, it may be different. Now, that doesn't mean sugar is good for you. Don't get me wrong. It doesn't mean that 12 ounces of a soft drink with white sugar is good for you, and 12 ounces with high fructose corn syrup is bad for you. It still is sugar. But yes, there is a difference between them, and it may be that one is more addictive than the other. Very good points. We don't know the full answer to that.
He said he ate real sugar, and when he was a kid, and there were very few overweight children. That was just
true, and maybe that's part of it. The other part of it is we used to go outside and play all the time. Yeah. We exercised more. There were fewer calories. There wasn't ultra processed food, so it's not quite as simple as sugar. But yes, we didn't weigh nearly as much. That is correct.
Tessa in Bayfield emailed to ask. Wants you to talk about what makes up a portion of the size of fruits, veggies, and protein. You know, first of all,
a good thing to do is Google it to look at it. That's, you know, that's one way to sort of look at it. So a portion of size, you know, I'd have to look exactly. You know, first of all, I believe that if you're going to have oranges, you should have an orange and not have orange juice, because then you get the pulp from the orange and you're getting more fiber, and it digests differently in your body. It doesn't spike the blood sugar that orange juice will do that. That's part of it. It's surprisingly small amounts, and only 40 to 50% of the population in Wisconsin does that. So I can't really do chapter and verse and exactly what it is, but it basically is sort of a handful of beans. Is a portion of beans. Handful of green beans would be one portion. But Google it and look at it that way, and visually then try to look at that. You know, before the upside-down food pyramid, the idea was a plate. If you remember, you know, there was the food pyramid, there was the plate, and the plate showed you how much should be on there for fruits and vegetables. So,
I want to go back to the alcohol for just a minute, because there's a gal by the name of Kaylee Dagey, who's a graduate mm-hmm. student at UW-Milwaukee, she's in their Master of Social Work, was writing about communities making it easier places to be sober.
Yes. Well, that's really important, because a lot of people like to go to a bar and mm-hmm. have a good time.
Yeah.
Well, why don't we have non-alcoholic bars? And maybe we will start to have that. You know, non-alcoholic beer, you know, I've had the NA beers like Athletic, and they taste really good. So maybe we'll be seeing in the future that there'll be NA bars where there will be mocktails, there'll be non-alcoholic beers. And there certainly are non-alcoholic nights that younger people are beginning to kickstart with that. And that is a good idea, because we associate alcohol with being together and having a good time. Certainly in the state of Wisconsin, that's part of it. And she is exactly right. We should have that. And frankly, we're a capitalistic society. If somebody has an NA bar and it starts to make a big dent and it starts to be popular and you have music and other things, you better believe that the Tavern League is going to be on that and say, you can have a tavern without alcohol, right?
Yeah.
Why not? Yeah. Why not have a tavern without alcohol? It's having a good time getting people together, and she has a very good point.
Very good point. And she actually noted half a dozen places around the state that are doing pretty well.
That's doing pretty well. Half a dozen is a tiny beginning within the state of Wisconsin.
Oh, yeah.
But it's a beginning. And that's how things change. They change with that. As long as you can, if you can see that you can start a tavern, which basically is an NA-type tavern, and you can make a living with that, people are going to start to do that.
Thinking way back to a tavern that opened here in Madison area that was a non-smoking tavern.
Right. That's
and
right.
It was a
and
big
it was a
deal.
Shock. That's right.
A big shock.
Who would have thought? Who would have thought? Exactly.
Oh, man.
Exactly.
Dr. Zorba, it's always a pleasure. You're going to be back again, and we'll do this all over
I
again.
I am. Thank you so much. And thanks for prompting my podcast, Stay Well with Dr. Zorba, Pastor. I love doing that. I love helping people. And thank you, Larry. Thank you, thank you, thank you.
Dr. Zorba will be back, and we will talk with him again fairly soon, as a matter of fact. Looking forward to that. Thank you for listening. And I hope you'll stay with us. Lots more in store here on WPR News. I'm Larry Mueller.